It is February 21st.
Let's set this down.
2024.
Welcome back to Metropolis. My name is Colden Datsunpo. I'm the host of this show. And you're the guest.
I am.
Look at that. So commanding. welcome back to the show. Drew Oyeje, executive director of CUTV and publisher of The Reach. How are you, Drew?
I'm great. Delighted to be here. Thanks for having me.
Of course, of course, of course. Happy to have you on. I think it's always a lively discussion when I have you here. It's always fun picking your brain on current events.
Indeed.
And boy, do we have some events that are current. Yeah, let's just get right into it. Let's go to...
let's jump into the current.
Yeah, let's go into this video we have. So this is... Legault making a statement to the press about the deal reached with the teachers, as we've spoken about before. The Front Commun was this incredibly huge, largest in North American history, labor action in terms of just numbers of people involved. And most of these teachers' unions, teachers' unions were some of the unions as that were a part of this. There's other... sort of public and parapublic workers who are part of that that front. But the teachers have sort of agreed to most of the...
the leadership, though, right?
The leadership, yes, correct.
The members still have to vote.
I think most of them are done voting.
Oh, have they? Are they done voting?
Okay. I mean, I think there's still a few of them, but from the people I've spoken to, like...
Nobody's holding out for a surge of last-minute no votes and a...
It doesn't seem like
a renewal of the strike.
It sort of seems like the majority of the teachers' unions have sort of agreed to it. Some of them that I spoke to understand that the deal doesn't quite work for the sector across the board, and mm-hmm. they're sympathetic to them. But I think there's a bit of a thing where it works for most people, and so it seems like any further strikes will be if any, it's sort of going to be like.
Yeah.
Well, what's it called? Localized to specific ones. I believe there was some FAU unions in Laval that were sort of not happy with the agreement. Yeah.
Well, as a union organizer colleague of mine once said, always vote no to a deal and yes to a strike.
So no to a deal, yes to a strike.
Yeah. That's your duty.
That's like the spirit.
That's your duty as a militant grassroots union member.
Yeah. I'm like, well, that means no deal would ever be reached.
yeah, exactly. You just keep getting better deals and going back to the table and it's going on strike again.
Yeah. More. I mean,
I mean, the idea is that you're never probably going to get more than 10% of people who are really like super militant. And so you just need, you need that anchor.
Of course.
Of people to, you know, to vote, to pull things in that direction.
It's like militant wall that people, yeah.
To agitate and influence the rest of the membership to fight for more, because, you know, I think it's a huge deal to get people out on strike and to go on picket lines and working and take a heavy financial burden of not being paid and everything. So people went through a lot of that. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, understandably, the people who are just like regular, you know, workers who hadn't really thought about that much about unions or that they're themselves as a union member before now probably are in a situation where they're pretty relieved not to be doing that anymore and happy to take whatever the government gives them. But, but there always is that. You know, sometimes it's minority, sometimes majority. If the leadership is perceived to be selling them short, who are gonna say no? It's not enough. Let's do it again until they budge more.
No to these deals. Yes to these strikes.
Exactly.
That should be a bumper sticker. This video we have coming up. So this is Legault announcing the big salary pitch to Quebec teachers. Mm-hmm. But he has an interesting thing that he ties. With this, you know, he talks about being confident about the choice of, I guess, of the raises that the salary raises he's given the teachers. But he doesn't make it like a he adds something to it. Let's watch the clip so we can hear it from the horse's mouth.
The only thing I said in French, I'll repeat that in English. First, there's no question about cutting services, all right? No austerity. Second, There's no question about increasing income taxes. We're already too high compared to our neighbors. So, of course, what it means is that we'll increase the deficit. It's a choice we make. I'm in agreement with myself regarding this choice, but I think it's a responsible choice, and it's the right choice for the future of Quebec.
Are you frustrated about it at all? I'm trying to read your tone here. Are you frustrated that this will lead to a higher deficit?
It's the opposite. I'm happy. I'm proud. Because I always said that education must be our top priority. So to invest in education is the right investment. Of course, I'm an accountant. So when you invest in education, it's an expense. But for me, I would like to write that as an investment.
The wider press conference, I have a little quote here. If we go to the next slide, we can read it out. Get out of here, Legault. Yeah, so this quote comes from this Cult Montreal article by Lorraine Carpenter titled Legault announces big move salary pitch to Quebec teachers and resulting budget deficits. Next slide, please. All right, so here we have a quote from this article. Legault said that the new starting salary for Quebec teachers, should this agreement be accepted, would be $65,000, while the highest salary level would be $109,000, representing increases between 18.6% and 27% with the compound effect. The province would also commit to creating 5,000 new permanent positions for teachers and 4,000 full-time equivalent classroom assistants. So in that, you have some of the... I mean, this is kind of a... you have some wins from the unions, some stuff they wanted to see. Like, this is like very far from the initial kind of like 9% over 5-year offer that the government initially gave. I do believe those increases are over a 5-year period, which, as we had a previous guest, Felix, said, is usually not what unions like to do, because it's like you can't really, like, once you're locked into that contract, you can't really like strike. And it's like this longer period of stability that the unions have to sort of like agree upon. That will be without strikes, and it's like a lot can happen within 5 years, right? It's like 5 years is like in economic terms, political terms, kind of an eternity. Like, so many things can happen and change the economic conditions. On maybe at the end of the 5 years, those raises might not be enough. But for now, the teachers do seem to be agreeing to it. Legault seems kind of happy with being, I guess, their partner in seeing these come into effect. You have those teachers, those classroom assistants were one of the bigger demands from these teachers' unions, as they were sort of like, as class sizes were getting larger and larger, students were sort of like burned out from COVID. Teachers as well, they kind of need more non-teacher help in classrooms. So they got to see that. Let's go to the next slide, where we have a direct quote from Legault. Producer, could you go to the next slide? It is the next slide? I'm blind. I am confident that with the agreement we signed, salary conditions in the education sector will become much more attractive and that we'll gradually fill all positions. But then here it is. But I want to say to all Quebecers, this choice will have financial consequences. What the? The next budget will be largely in deficit because of this choice, among many others. But we do it for the good of the Quebec nation. As premier, I fully accept this. It's a responsible choice to make. And then now you see him kind of talking about what he did in the video, talking about this deficit. I guess I selected this article for us to talk about, Drew, because I think it's kind of interesting to sort of announce this kind of like... I guess he's trying to tie in, like he's trying to tie in this win, I think, for union. The way I read this, at least, is he's tying in this like win for the unions, this win for the teachers, for the most part, teachers' unions. And he's trying to say, yeah, you have your win, but we also have a deficit. But he's saying with a smiling face, right? He's like, we have a deficit, but that's just kind of how it goes. I sort of think there's this kind of attempt. This is kind of like thing of like optics here.
I think what we're seeing here, the first thing that sort of strikes me about all these different things is the civilizing effect of social movements. I mean, Francois Legault, as he said, he's an accountant and what he didn't say is that, but what's obvious is that he's an ideological, you know, neoliberal.
I don't think
died in the wool. So this would be someone who's deficit zero, you know, he's a zero deficit guy through and through, and yet he's willing to run a deficit. And specifically denounce austerity in the same breath, basically.
Right. There will be no budget cuts.
Yeah,
there will be,
and that goes back to the public sector strikes of 2015, when the students got out in the streets early and started basically an anti-austerity movement. They were, you know, articulated a very clear anti-austerity message, and then that was picked up by the public sector unions, and there's like 200,000 people in the streets. Mm-hmm. Obviously, I think that's one sort of way to periodize what we're seeing here.
His position right
which
now.
Which is, a right-wing neoliberal government denouncing austerity and saying that they're willing to run a deficit for the good of the nation. That said, I don't think that there's any reason why they have to run a deficit. He said, basically the way neoliberals like to frame things is like you can either raise taxes on everybody, including the platonic neoliberal subject. Middle class subject, which is to say it's going to eat into your income. Or you can run a deficit. Those are basically
right,
the
only
options.
Two options.
Yeah, as opposed to taxing banks, taxing capital, taxing real estate speculation, taxing all kinds of things that mm-hmm. could be taxed without mm-hmm. really without social impact and with a lot of social benefit potentially.
Sure.
But all those things are still off the table. So we've got a ways to go. But I would say. I just looking at where we are between the explicit pro-austerities, you know, deficit zero mentality of the liberal government that preceded him, I think, you know, we've made some progress in terms of our constraining the enthusiasm of our neoliberal politicians.
Yeah, I think I really like that point. It's something I hadn't realized, I guess, but like it's true that like I guess like when you look back in the past, you have like. Was it like Charest like announcing like 30% raises for tuition, right? That got like students in the streets.
Yeah.
And then you had that kind of prolonged effort that sort of like resisted these like further austerity kind of like attempts.
Yeah.
And now it's to the point where they understand that like they can't do that, right? They like it's like because of that big social showing, this kind of big like social action, the politicians understand what the floor is and they're trying to avoid like sort of like antagonizing people in that kind of way. And this sort of like this is not
and the public sector strike the Franco-Communist strike was wildly popular among the public that's a new development as well
huge yeah. they know kind of announcing a kind of austerity or these kinds of further cuts is going to be kind of politically almost like impossible for them right especially mm-hmm. I mean especially with Legault kind of doing like and Legault and the CAC kind of doing terribly in the polls provincial polls you have the PQ on sort of on the rise there's.
I wanted to bring up one other thing.
Of course,
hold that thought. It's just that you know they got some significant pay increases. Maybe not as significant enough to keep pace with inflation in some cases, but nonetheless, nothing to sneeze at. But teachers, you can see in that first quote there, excuse me, that the teachers also were demanding not just. Pay increases for themselves, but generally better service for students or better learning conditions for students. And I think you see here, which is probably undersold across the board in the corporate media, is that teachers' unions don't just fight for themselves. They fight for their students as well because they care about them. Thousands of new assistant and teaching positions is going to have an impact on class sizes, on the amount of tension that students with special needs get, the amount of attention that students in general get. Mm-hmm. That's a real, you know, I'm not going to say it fixes any problems. I would expect that it does not fully fix any problems, but it does move in the right direction. Right. And that's fully the result of the strike, you know, like, without that, you know, they would just keep increasing class sizes. Having more students, you know, with special needs, you know, dealing with fewer assistants, and that would just keep being the trend line. But instead, you have a public sector union that's fighting for itself, but also fighting for the public interest and the next generation.
Yeah, I feel like we see that a lot. Where it's like, I mean, we'll see later with like a discussion about healthcare. I have people like kind of like nurses talking to me about like, well, nurses I've spoken to that are part of these strikes. We're talking about like it's not just like a thing of like. Like some people might expect or sort of understand these strikes as like it's sort of just for their own salaries, right? It's sort of only for like to make sure that they're getting their dues. But I think like you're saying, it's much more than that. It's to improve these sort of like public institutions that they're a part of because they are like right there at like the front lines of these systems and they see whether or not the people they're serving, whether for in the case for teachers, whether it's their students, for nurses, mm-hmm. whether it's the patients, right? Are they being served well? And if, of course, if teachers are like incredibly overburdened, then they understand that like they're doing their job much less like
and efficiently and or effectively. It's them, not the Chamber of Commerce or the various deficit hawks in the government who have to like talk to those parents and be like, I'm sorry.
Sorry.
That's your kid has to learn with like dollar store stuff bought by the teacher because we don't have a budget to buy like real, you know, art supplies or
it's whatever. Like, sorry, it is, that's the way it is. Your student has to be one of 200 people in this kindergarten, you know?
Not quite there yet, but
that is, I mean,
this, here's hoping. Yeah.
I think that's more just to say, like, I guess there's this idea of like, sort of like just per like public client, right? Mm-hmm. If we think of like a public client for school, it'd be like, let's say the student, their family, mm-hmm. For the healthcare system, it's like the patient, their family, or like whatever, like extended kind of people. There's this, I guess, with these, with the kind of cuts or with the kind of, not always cuts, but with the kind of overburdening of the people at the front lines of this, whether it's teachers, nurses, there's this kind of idea of like, how do we like get them, like, how do we get the most out of these teachers, right? How do we get the most out of these like nurses? And it's going to be by like either making it so they just, the workload kind of increases, giving them more students, almost like in the thing of like kind of just like pure like production line, like mm-hmm. productivity, mm-hmm. right? Like how many like students can we cram in one class?
Yeah.
And then here we have, I mean, all just to say, there's that kind of effort, right, from one front. And then here we have the teachers not only saying like, I want more money for this, but this doesn't work. This like, because this kind of way that you're trying to like overburden me with so many students is bad for the teachers, it's bad for the students. And the mm-hmm. only thing it's really like good for, I guess, would be like some kind of like accounts, right? Of like, mm-hmm. if we're looking at like where like this like client to public servant kind of list. Yeah. Yeah. And I guess, yeah, all just to say,
absolutely.
The strikes are a great tool at resisting such efforts to make these production lines of public institutions more efficient.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're going to see in some of the other items here is just the obsession with squeezing more out of fewer, more effort out of fewer people. And at a certain point, you have to invest in increasing the capacity of the system. And the only social force that's available that's pushing for that in a effective and large scale way is, you know, public sector unions right now. Yeah. You know, would that it were otherwise, but that's what we've got. So
it'll be interesting to see how these... I mean, it's going to be such a long-term thing, but I guess how these contracts over the next 5 years are going to sort of pan out, what kind of conditions, mm-hmm. economic conditions these contracts will be subject to, and we'll see, whether or not there will be a...
If inflation averages out to 3.5% or something, then, you know, it basically zeros out. But if it spikes again, then things could go awry.
That's not good. I don't like when things go awry. Before we go back into this kind of discussion on the public sector, I have something kind of curious. You ever been to Pointe Claire, Drew?
I have, yeah. I've been to the Fairview Mall, in fact.
Whoa, Fairview Mall, classic. A classic. Yeah.
I mean, not to be missed if you're going to the West Island.
Of course. I mean, West Island does have some nice stuff. I love St. Anne de Bellevue, like around John Abbott. Mm-hmm. Beautiful mm-hmm. little college town.
Yeah.
The area is nice. I was there. I was in Pointe Claire just this Sunday. Again, like a chart reading done. But that's sort of like, I remember at this thing, it's like, and there's no contention or any kind of ill will. There's a specific kind of crowd. Mm-hmm. I was the only Asian guy there. It was kind of mostly suburban moms, I would say, who might also frequent that mall.
But it's possible.
There was someone else in Pointe Claire recently.
Or the health food store in Pointe Claire, potentially.
Okay. The health food store.
Well, I don't know if they're getting their charts read. I'm just reading the demographic here.
Yeah, I'm going there next, actually. But someone else was in Pointe Claire recently.
Indeed.
Not just me.
Good friend of yours?
I would not say so. Conservative Party leader, Federal Conservative Party leader, Pierre Poilievre was in Pointe Claire this weekend. Not this weekend, sorry. 5 days ago.
The man with the annoying voice.
The man with the annoying voice, yeah. As people have said. As I'm quoting someone, but they said the man who looks like Milhouse.
from the they Simpsons. Also call him that, yeah.
Yes, but this is a quote. I'm quoting someone else on this. Yeah, so here we have... Why was Pierre Polyev in Pointe Claire, you might ask? Some of the audience members might be asking. Well, he was there to denounce bureaucracy that he says has been stalling housing projects.
Say it ain't so.
Oh, sorry, remind me of the song. How do you feel about bureaucracy, Drew?
I feel, I'm a big fan of public sector unions. I'm less a fan of top-down structures, but I think I might be looking ahead to the next item. But I think regulations can be good if they're good regulations.
Yeah.
But you know, when it comes to housing, there's a decidedly mixed bag at play. So
here we have Pierre Polyev sort of conjuring the classic opponent of conservatives, right?
Red tape.
Mm-hmm. Big government. Why the hell is it so big? It should be smaller. It's so big, in fact, that it's so inefficient, right? Usually, I guess the conservative argument goes that, like, government should be smaller so private entities, whether it's gigantic corporations or mom-and-pop shops, can do their own thing without being stalled or inhibited in pursuit of capital and family values. Let's go to the next slide. We have a quote from him. All right. So he's calling out the Prime Minister here, Prime Minister Trudeau. He says... Let's get this right. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has caused this problem by funding local bureaucracies that block home building. Polyev claimed he repeated statements he has made in the past about local governments holding up housing. Last month, he accused Montreal Mayor Valerie Plante and Quebec City Mayor Bruno Marchand of incompetence and causing tens of thousands of housing units to be stalled. On Thursday, he blamed the city of Pointe Claire for blocking the first phase of a Cadillac Fairview development destined to be built on part of the mall's parking lot. Here we are next. Oh, I think this
might even call it the Cadillac of. Consumer of oh my god,
take your time with this. It's on the board, the Cadillac.
I almost had it. The Cadillac of commuter housing. I forgot the word commuter.
Cadillac,
but now I remembered it.
Commuter housing. Oh yeah, I would read that book from Black Rose. The Cadillac of commuter housing. All right. Yeah, so, I mean, he goes on to say, he's like, he does this from, like, a parking lot. You see in the background, you see the sort of, like, REM line, the sort of new, what do they call it? REM. It's like the light rail, light transit.
Mm-hmm.
Light rail transit, I think.
Réseau électrique de métropolitaine.
Express, I think.
Is it Express now?
Yeah.
They keep changing it.
I thought it was Express always.
Électrique for a while.
Oh, yeah. Whoa, look at that. That's quite the difference. Yeah, I guess it's gas powered now.
I think there was probably Electrique when they were trying to pitch it to like as like a green project,
right?
But then when they're going consumer facing,
Express
is the way to go, even though it's not so Express from what I hear.
No, the whole problem with those systems is that like I think the one they built in Vancouver that's sort of based off the SkyTrain was like at capacity within like a year.
Yeah, exactly.
It's sort of not really future proofed. Already though, I feel like the parts of that rail line that are open is like just like was it a week ago, 2 weeks ago? It was like experiencing like hour long delays, which is not very reliable. Not really what you want.
Yeah, you don't love to see it.
Public transit, and then people are going to be like, "Oh, see, public transit doesn't work. I need a big car." It's a good thing we have small cars. All right. So I have another quote from this article. Here we are next to a federally funded future transit station, and the local owner wants to develop apartments and housing in this parking lot. But local bureaucracy is blocking that construction that would allow seniors and students to live next to a massive transit station that would take them to McGill University or to the airport. He added that a conservative government would incentivize municipalities through the gas tax transfer, which is up for renewal in March. His plan would provide bonuses to cities that build more than a predetermined target and penalize those that don't build enough housing. All new transit projects would also have to include a housing component. The Pointe Claire mayor didn't really like those statements of his.
Was not pleased.
Pointe Claire mayor Tim Thomas, not to be confused with... old Boston Bruins goalie, countered that too many housing units have been built without much thought given to the best way to design the urban fabric. Let's sort of take the discussion there.
Tim Thomas, the goalie, would probably be on Poliev's side on this one. Not on this one, but in general, yeah.
He's
a bit of a right winger, as I recall.
Okay, yeah. See, I didn't know that. I just know that he loves getting into fights.
Yeah.
Like goalie fights.
He likes the war of words. He likes the war of other things, too.
Yeah. Actually, look at that. Look at that. I guess.
Truculence, I think it was called. Yeah.
Truculence. Yeah, I guess there's so much to talk about here. I think there's the choice of Poliev sort of doing this endpoint.
Did we have a clip of Poliev? No clip?
No clip for this one because it was a little too long.
Fair enough, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I just thought people would want to. I mean, we pitched his looks, we pitched his vocal range, and now people aren't going to get the payoff. But so it goes. You can look up the clip yourself if you want.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's particularly interesting in this particular location because there's two kinds of housing that are happening here. One is, a developer wants to build a kind of an apartment building in an underused parking lot.
Yeah, next to a mall.
Next to a mall, next to a transit stop. I mean, you know, in theory, that sounds great. Obviously, I'd prefer it to be, you know, social housing built by the government or by a co-op. But, you know, still like a socially good thing to do. But then the same developer also wants to like mow down a local forest and like build like, you know, a subdivision, basically.
Of course.
And so what's blocking both of these things is the urban planning process in this small town. And so, and not small town, but in this suburb, and the mayor's obviously now in a war of words with Poliev, which is clearly what Poliev wants. But yeah, I mean, I think this sort of shows the pitfalls of this sort of like blanket build everything everywhere mentality. You know, basically it's the like urban planning model of like a Houston, Texas, where it's just like, okay, you got land. Let's put some subdivisions on it, and no restrictions. Just go.
Yeah, yeah.
And housing developers love it. And yeah, Poliev, it should be noted, has gotten some hefty donations from various CEOs of real estate investment trusts and other sort of real estate speculation interests. So that should be on the in the background, And so less bureaucracy, more construction is the name of the game here, and that's what that does is you're gonna have both of those things. I think the key fundamental point that I would want to make about that is just that if you the private sector, the people who can invest in housing on a large scale and build housing on a large scale have class consciousness. Basically, they understand that when real estate prices are high and when housing prices are high, they benefit.
Right.
And they understand that when housing prices fall, they're going to make less money.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're definitely willing to build more housing. And, Poliev's plan unleashes them to do that in a kind of an unorganized way that would make a lot of profit for them.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not going to build so much housing that housing prices actually fall to any significant degree. I think big capital is coordinated enough to keep that from happening. So there is demand is outstripping supply at the moment, which is causing ridiculous. So, you know, the best you could hope for from this is maybe housing prices stabilize and don't keep going up like crazy.
Mm-hmm.
But you're not going to get a situation where it actually makes housing prices go down. And the other fundamental problem with this is that and both, you know, liberals and conservatives know this, and the NDP to some extent know this, is that a key constituency, people who are much more likely to vote and much more likely to be loud in terms of representing their own interests, are homeowners.
Of course.
These are people with, if you own a home, especially if you've paid off the mortgage, like you're in much better shape than any renter, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're sitting on a capital asset that's worth a huge amount of money on the one hand, and you have less rent to pay on the other. And so you're more politically powerful and your interests are aligned with keeping housing prices high because you want that capital asset to be protected.
Of course.
And so that's what you see in these sort of urban planning policies. It's a mixed bag of, oh, we want to plan for environmental impacts. We want to make sure that, you know, biodiversity is there. We want to make sure that, you know, the streets are safe to walk on, that there's mixed transit options, all these things. So those are all, you know, objectively good things.
Sure.
Especially if you can keep housing prices down. But the other thing that these local governments are doing is protecting homeowners, because homeowners are a loud and powerful source of donations and votes, and also pressure. And so
they also make a decent amount of the actual like people in charge as well, right?
Yeah. I mean, the like fundamental clash of interest between the homeowner class and everyone else is pretty crucial here. And I think, you know, in the 90s and 2000s, when you had a majority of the population, basically the majority of the voting population is homeowners, you know, that's when a lot of these policies got set. That's when the social housing budget and the budget to build federally funded housing, co-ops, you know, state-run housing and so on, was sliced and diced all through the 90s. But, you know, there's a lot of people who were either not voting age or weren't even born yet then, who are now becoming voting age, who are like, how are we supposed to access like a, you know, $500,000 house, or a million in on the island of Montreal, $1 million house? Like, how am I supposed to figure out a down payment of that when I'm paying $2,600 a month? As you know, and as Polyev rightfully pointed out, like, the average rent has tripled since he was in cabinet. You know, he's trying to suggest that that's because he had good housing policies and that then the Liberals made it triple.
Of course.
But it's actually the continuous policies of Conservative and Liberal governments that have made rents triple in Montreal.
Right. That made property values sort of like continue to kind of go up.
Yeah.
That sort of protects like property, especially as it's like protecting property, because that is the wealth, that's the majority, like, for most people, that's like the biggest kind of like a chunk of like personal wealth, right? And then the people who have that as a big chunk of personal wealth, they're also the voters, they're voters as well. Because they understand that these two parties are going to protect their interests to varying degrees.
And Polyev also pointed out, and it's a totally legit point outside of the, I don't know, the dishonesty of him, you know, in his political agenda. But it is a totally legitimate point, is that like people are taking on these mortgages that are now going to take multiple generations to pay off. Whereas like in the past, maybe you could pay off a mortgage in 25 years. Now that's an absurd hope. And so you're basically giving money to the banks for, you know, generations at this point, to acquire a house. And yeah, so you have people who got in the 80s, 90s, when you could buy a house for, you know, maybe not a reasonable price, but a much lower price.
Or a
price that was accessible to somebody with like a middle class income.
Yeah.
But now that's totally out of reach. You have to save for like your entire life to even get a down payment going.
It used to be two nickels and a bit of lint, then you could buy a house.
Just empty your pockets and it'll be like, mortgage, sign here.
You want to buy this house? How much you got on you? Like, a lollipop, sex, old.
Give or take. That's how it was.
That's what it feels like, I guess, at least from this this current juncture we're at. I think there's something really interesting that you're saying about like, I guess, the type of people he's speaking to with these kinds of policies. Because it's like, there is some things where he's like, he's able to point at something, right? That like people feel materially about like the difficulties of the housing crisis, the lack of housing, the kind of whatever, the sky high price of rent, and like as well as mortgages, which is being money funneled straight to the banks, right?
Yeah.
But then it's like his own suggestions here, at least, are like, They're kind of just in the I think this specific article and these kind of specific things that he's kind of talking about, like he's talking about like, oh, this what was it, this like 25 story residential tower, oh, how the city's kind of blocking it. There's a way that he's trying to frame this as like the city's trying to block whatever, like solutions to the housing crisis, right?
And he blamed specifically the 2020 rule, which is the Projet Montréal's bylaw that says, when you build new housing in Montreal, you have to, 20% has to be affordable, 20% has to be social, and 20% has to be family.
Right.
But what he neglected to mention, sorry, go ahead.
No. You're going to mention it right now.
What he neglected to mention is that they left a huge loophole in there, which is you can toss a few bucks into a fund and ignore the whole thing. That's not holding back very much at all, I would say. If
every
anything,
developer has chosen to do that they had to be faced with that, right? Because the thing of like...
I mean, it actually sounds good on paper in the sense that, okay, let's take the housing demand and harness that to make more social and affordable housing. I mean, affordable in big quotes, with a big grain of salt, because it's not affordable. It's just
it's such a loose term, right? That's the kind of at least I from people I've spoken to.
But certainly the social part. I mean, 20% social is nothing to sniff at. But
yes, correct.
But it doesn't exist. I think I think we said this on a previous show, but in Park X or in Mile X, I guess, they built this forest of condos, just, you know, hundreds of units. And all the money that went in was like amounted to like less than $1 million or something. So it's like, okay, cool. Buy yourself two condos. You know,
here you go. Housing crisis.
That's not exactly 20%. So
yeah. It's like crumbs to it all. There's a certain strategy to that. And even like all of this, it's sort of like you're saying, trying to like, let's use the market. Let's try and like ride this kind of like waves of development by like having the stipulation.
Yeah. It's a mirage.
Yeah. It's a total mirage. Exactly. Yeah. Because these, I think,
but like, it looks real until you get there and you're like, oh, I'm still thirsty. Sorry.
Yeah. Are you thirsty, brother? You water? You good?
I got some. Yeah. I'm all terrific, set. Terrific. Yeah, not subconsciously channeling my inner desires here.
I think there's something about it where it's like, To me, there's this the angle of like these developers, and they're like the private developers who are building these kinds of massive units, mm-hmm. right? And it's like, why aren't they like helping? Like, why are they choosing to pay it? Like, why aren't they choosing to build these little? Like, why aren't they choosing to abide by the 2020 stuff? Mm-hmm. And I think there's this kind of clear like thing of like,
It's expensive.
It's expensive.
Yeah.
There's a clear thing of profit where it's like to build like a big house. To build a house is not cheap, right? And mm-hmm. you want to try to like maximize every dollar you put into this, like these developments, right? That's why you sort of have it so that, I mean, like, I don't know if you've ever been in any of these kind of newer like condo buildings. They're like, they feel like Norwegian prisons where it's like,
comfy, somewhat unsettling.
Yeah. It's like, okay, yeah, I have the amenities here, you know, and I have been to Norwegian prison and I don't have plan on going to Norwegian prison. But like, if I had to go to a prison, not the worst one to end up in, right?
Yeah, probably it'd be on the top of my list as well of prisons to live in.
Yeah, get me extradited immediately to Scandinavia. No, but I mean, the statement is essentially like, you have these kinds of like very clean setups, you know, you have your like space for your TV, your couch, you have essentially like, it's like you have the checklist of amenities, right?
Yeah.
But they're all kind of like, it's still prison. It's still kind of like cramped. And mm-hmm. a lot of these units, like, I think they're, not all of them, because of course they still built like the top 2-floor penthouses. So they have like whatever, like big money, like coming into the top. But like, these are like really cramped. And the reason they're cramped, of course, is they're trying to maximize like buyer unit per like whatever square footage of these buildings, right? Yeah. There's, I mean, it's like it should be obvious, of course, that like these developers are trying to make money off these things, and they're trying to make the most money off these things. And you do not make money, they do not make money off making affordable housing. They do not make money off making social housing.
And not family housing either, because you're not going to add bedrooms when you can. Why add bedrooms when your like
bedrooms in this Norwegian prison? No chance.
Exactly.
What kind of guess? But it's like sometimes like a lot of these like condo units, it feels like they've reduced like the concept of home to just really like where you sleep or just kind of the space you're just kind of in for like a brief amount of time before you go to work, and then work is and whatever third spaces that the city offers is sort of like. Are supposed to give you whatever kind of like warmth or like comfort.
Community life. Yeah.
Community life. Thank you.
Certainly that's not, community life is not something that you think of when you're walking down the halls of one of those condos. That's for sure.
No. And I guess all that to say, they have, I think what stands out to me about this kind of press conference that he's giving out in like next, like in just like a mall parking lot, which is like so funny. I think it's just like, it's to me, what I think is kind of obvious is that he's sort of like siding with developers. There's this idea that like, it's like you have these private developers who are building these massive Norwegian prisons, and they're sort of like, no, we're trying to solve the housing crisis by offering you these like really expensive units that, again, most of them are going to be sitting empty, most likely, right? Like, we have like a bunch of those buildings that are sort of like that style of like massive residential tower that have been sort of built on Kranjelovec. Most of them are empty, right? Because you have
certainly not a lot of stuff on the balcony.
Yes, yes. I mean, yeah, that's
either,
always
either
telling.
All these people are like Marie Kondo, like aficionados and strict followers,
yeah,
or
yeah.
they don't live there.
No, yeah, no, exactly. I mean, yeah, no. It's all this to say is like you have this kind of thing of like trying to build more. And like I think the argument of trying to build more housing or like that the housing crisis can be solved by building more units, if we follow that logic, then naturally what we should be doing is building just like absolutely massive towers, right? Mm-hmm. And but the thing is, we have been, and that has not been solving the crisis.
No.
Because I think we spoke about this a little before, but like you have a lot of times, especially with how housing is treated, like we were saying before.
Well, yeah, I mean, we talk about Saudi princes and stuff, but it's also just like, you know, doctors and stuff in Montreal who are like, oh, what is the best way to park
money.
A couple hundred thousand dollars or $1 million
yeah.
in an investment property because you know the value is going to just keep appreciating at way, way faster than like any index fund or mutual fund or anything else. So, you know, great.
And you see,
and you have a second home you can go to sometimes.
You see that kind of second logic as well. And like that kind of logic also in like whatever, like hedge funds and like these like big like account managers in the States and like what, like Bay Street, Wall Street, where they're realizing that like, oh, like, what is like a safe thing to invest in real estate, right? And then they're just buying up swaths of like houses, single family homes, bunch of units in these apartment buildings. They recommend that to their clients. And so they do that. And these places just sit empty. Prices go up and the situation gets worse for everyone.
And they take 0.01% of the profits and donate to Pierre Poilievre.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, that's it. And I'm pretty sure that's probably how this happened. I mean, it's pure conjecture at this point, but yeah.
I just have to say, like, I mean, I obviously am on record, you know, having an opinion about his voice in English, but but he actually made some headlines. I saw some headlines go by about, like, Pierre Poilievre shutting down a journalist by saying, who asked him to repeat an answer in English, and he's like, we're in Quebec here. We speak French. And then, but if you listen to his French, it's absolutely halting. And he's like constantly stopping and searching for words and very, very bumbling performance, I would say.
I feel like that's always a problem with the Conservative Party leaders. They're sort of like never really like have like any kind of fluent French. Well, at least the ones I've experienced in my lifetime. They're always sort of
I remember
robotic is the word that comes to mind.
Exactly. I mean, at the convention, he was, his wife grew up in Montreal. So, all the reporters were saying he was like leaning, depending on her to like connect to the Francophone audience.
That's so funny. Whoa, don't talk to me, pal. Talk to my wife.
Exactly.
Anyways, let's switch topics. Let's go back to
absolutely.
Let's go back to provincial politics. Legoland, Quebec. Let's see. So here we have an opinion piece by Clifford Lincoln. I just learned who this guy was. Interesting guy. This opinion piece, published in the Gazette, February 19, 2024, is titled "Opinion." Quebec can ill afford to isolate itself from the real world. And the subheading, more than ever, investment has a choice, and the choices beyond this province are as welcoming as they are numerous. What do you read from that, Drew? What are you expecting from this? just off the title alone.
Off the title? I mean, some hackneyed Canadian nationalism is what I'm expecting. There and this... I mean, I do not know much about the author, but he certainly sounds like a Montreal Gazette subscriber's idea of a really effective politician.
Yes, correct.
Based of course, on his resume,
which is to say, he's not. Clifford Lincoln was a former Liberal Party MP as well as the Quebec Liberal Party MNA. He's kind of like a real old school liberal. Like he was like a colonial, like civil servant. During like the Bourassa years, him and another minister, they resigned from cabinet because of Bourassa using the notwithstanding clause to make it so that French was the only that made it so French had to be the dominant language on commercial signs, which is to me like, I mean, to resign over that, it kind of shows how much stake you put into that, just that kind of like convenience of language, right? Of like how much, to me, he seems like someone who wants everything to be in English or everything has a right to be in English. And you sort of see that, I guess, in this article, at least this article about the kind of province Legault is turning Quebec into. Let's go to the next slide. I have a nice little quote from him here. This is sort of at the end of the article. He starts to get a little poetic after a long and tedious
refreshing breezes.
Yeah, I know, I know. Huh?
Aren't we all waiting for those?
After a long and tedious winter, we all earnestly await the return of spring and its refreshing breezes. How invigorating as well would it be to be able to open our political doors and windows to the fresh air of open-mindedness and of confidence in ourselves for a positive future of mutual trust and understanding. Yes, it is high time for us to open ourselves to the world at large and the richness of its global diversity. So, I mean, he finishes off with that, but I mean, the most of this article, he's just talking about, like, Bill 96, he's talking about the way English is sort of being attacked. He talks about the beautiful Roddick Gates, the Chronicles of Roddick. Mm-hmm. I kind of stole that joke from you.
You buried the delivery too, so I'm yeah. It's done now.
Totally dropped
it. We turn now to a segment we'd like to call the Chronicles of Roddick.
Oh, there you go. That's better. Yeah. Chronicles of Roddick. The Gates.
Had to edit there, yeah.
The Gates, the Roddick Gates of Hell. I don't know. Okay, I guess I chose this article because I think there's this sort of, much less about any kind of specific quotes from it, I think there's this sort of angling that I think is interesting to see, kind of like still alive. And is this?
Yeah, this is a real relic. But you know, we're playing the hits here.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Let's put the oldies on.
Yeah,
that's I'm sure what the editor said when they asked him to when he asked them to publish this.
Yeah, we need a real 1993 take on this issue.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess the angle that I think is surprising to see here is this sort of like. This is to me. This kind of rings, like the tone of it rings to someone who's sort of experienced the capital flight that happened in Quebec.
Yeah, exactly.
After
exactly.
The referendum years, yeah. Like the referendum, Quebec referendums happened. Sort of like, of course, like yeah, like these international corporations kind of got cold feet. They didn't see it as a place that was sort of like politically stable. Yeah. They didn't see it also as a place that was not just politically stable, but as a place that would might become. Sort of like that might become what is it like almost unfriendly to international capital in a certain way, right? And I mean
you actually had the independentist movement saying slogans like 101 or 401 referring to the language law that they put through
of course
in the late 90s early 2000s and yeah the
Ontario
the,
Highway
the, yeah the idea being yeah hit the road to Toronto if you don't like it and you know and in this era a lot of headquarters moved, you know, Montreal was Canada's sort of major city at a certain point.
It's and Petropolis, some might say.
No, exactly. No longer a lot of the headquarters moved to move to Toronto.
Much more business, corporate friendly.
Yeah, and so you can walk down like Saint-Jacques or, some of these, you know, streets and see these giant buildings that are, you know, clearly intended to be the headquarters of like the, you know, some bank or something.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
But they're just like a co-working space or something now. You know? Or, you know, some offices. Yeah.
Oh, how far they have fallen.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's just, to me it's like you have this sort of like argument, and it's interesting because it's like there's some nuance between like the kind of the way that Legault sort of tries to invite international players like Amazon, right? You have this sort of like Legault's sort of like I want to call it soft nationalism. It's not quite soft, but it's soft in the sense that he's not trying to like actually like nationalize any like industry, right? He's not trying to like.
I would call it like a simulacrum of nationalism. It's like a copy of a copy at this point.
Yeah, like, I guess Legault's nationalism is much more just kind of like cultural, like purely kind of like it summons these kinds of specters of nationalism.
But it's also just like totally cynical. I mean, the whole premise of the CAQ of the CAQ is to say like, okay, we're gonna have a little bit of nationalism. But we're not going to separate from Canada. We're not going to threaten that. We're like literally his promise was we're going to have a 20-year moratorium on a referendum.
Right.
So maybe in 20 years, but not right now.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you get to have all the like, oh, we're fighting for Quebec's, you know, rights to win, you know, which is theoretically fine. But without any of the actual threats. So, and so, yeah, you're never going to have, I mean, the idea that you would have people chanting a slogan like 101 or 401 these days is like, I mean, it sounds absurd.
Yeah, I can't imagine that happening in kind of the current like climate.
Yeah, you're not interested in threatening transnational capital at all. Maybe you want them to spend, you know, an extra 1% of their marketing budget on changing the labels on the shampoo bottles or whatever. But like, you're, you know, to make the French words more prominent. Yeah, but like, yeah, you're not going to fundamentally challenge anything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's the whole premise of the CAC. And so, and they've found tremendous electoral success. It should be said.
They, of course.
Having that promise of like sort of promising, you know, sort of tax cuts and $500 checks to the middle class while pressing the like, you know, linguistic pride button, was an incredible vote getter, right up until, you know, a few months, unfortunately, after the last election, they started plummeting in the polls and it was like, oh, you pressed the button one too many times. and yeah, it's like, okay, if you stoke people like that for real, they're going to go for the real deal eventually. And that's why that's one of the reasons why the PQ is rising in the polls against all odds. I mean, they seem like a spent force at a certain
point. They won like three MPs.
They were nothing, but now they're leading in the polls. You know, and it's partially thanks to, you know, that those engines being started again. Mm-hmm. And so yeah, I feel like, you know, Democrats in the US and to some extent, you know, the NDP constantly learns this lesson in Canada too. Like, if you're going to pretend to be something and like valorize that, then people are just going to go for the real thing. Like, they're not going to accept like a social democratic party that's pretending to be in favor of austerity or balanced budgets.
Right, right. Well, just be honest. Be yourself.
Why would I go to you for that?
It's like, I have the guy I trust to do that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You don't get fish at the diner. You know, you go there for the cheap breakfast.
You don't get fish at the diner. I like that. I've done that.
I made that mistake myself.
My friend I was with
was like, what are you doing? this is not what you order here. It's just not what you do.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Never again.
There you go. That's good.
Mistakes of my 20s.
That should have been the episode title.
There's still time.
Yeah. I think going back to this guy, Clifford Lincoln, I think there's a sort of like,
yeah,
it's almost like outdated kind of like approach to it. Cause it's like, I don't really like, again, it's like he's pointing at stuff that's like, I think it's true, but it sort of like takes things away from the direction I think we should be having the discussion in, right? It takes things, it keeps this kind of discussion about like being Legault and being for Legault or being against Legault as a term of, in terms of just pure language, right? It kind of falls into that kind of like pure like cultural battle, right? And it's not to say that Legault isn't, of course, like making things difficult for universities here or like the English community with like I guess the policies, but it's not to say that those are like sort of like those are like the kind of like out like the stated goals to sort of rile up his base. But like, I always saw like the kind of university stuff, it's just kind of just like another way to like institute like austerity, right? Just on like just like a much smaller like micro level than like before. Like, if we think about like Charest, like 30% like tuition increase across the board, that obviously riled up too many feathers. But for Legault, if he can tap into the kind of like the people who sort of want French domination.
Yeah. But it's super smart politics, right? Because you say all the students are going to get a $500 bursary cut or whatever. Yeah. You pick a fight on that basis. Yeah. You've just united all the students.
Yeah, there you go.
Whereas Legault is like, oh, well, I'll just pick off the Anglo students.
Yeah.
And the Francophone students going to stand up and fight for the Anglo students. Mm-hmm. No,
I haven't really
it's
seen
not
that.
Gonna happen. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And what an incredible way to divide people and get through the agenda that you want to get through.
Of course, you're adding definition to these kinds of like identitarian cultural kind of like identities that people have, and instead of any kind of like front, which should be of course like material or like an actual kind of like working kind of like life that people share. Mm-hmm. And to me, this piece by Clifford Lincoln kind of like, I guess,
But I mean, it goes both ways, because the Anglophones on the island of Montreal and in general in Quebec have been riled up to such an extent to be so freaked out about separatism and have their own version of linguistic divisiveness and vote along those lines,
Of course.
And so
that's why the West Island majority Anglo votes Liberal.
Exactly, so just every single time. Yeah, just lockstep. But people in the rest of Quebec see them getting attacked and they're like, I mean, maybe they're not happy about it, but they're pretty ambivalent about it at best, just like,
suck it up.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, maybe not even. Maybe it's like, oh, yeah, that's a bad idea, but I don't really care.
Yeah, yeah.
Distant from it. Doesn't affect me.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, like you're saying, it's smart for the CAC to sort of do that, to kind of have that, whatever, like.
I mean, it's probably economically stupid just in terms of like the Quebec economy. It's probably not a smart move, but yeah. But in terms of advancing a neoliberal agenda and creeping that in and into the universities.
Yeah.
And then you do it, in 5 years to the Francophone university, you're like, well, we already did this, no big deal.
Yeah. I don't know.
It's already a precedent at that point.
Yeah. I think there's just something about this was it Clifford Lincoln piece that I think, like, if we're thinking about...
Yeah, this guy really got to you, eh?
Yeah, it's just like... He speaks at this...
The old school Canadian nationalist with, like, zero substance beyond, like...
That's it.
Beyond voting no.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. It's like, come on, we're all, like, Anglos, and, like, Quebec is sort of, like, diminishing how we could be playing in the world, right? Because, like, there's something I see of, like, this echo of, like, old empire that he used to kind of be, a civil servant for. Like, he was literally, like, an imperial kind of, like, worker. And, like, I think with that, working in that kind of machine, there's a natural logic that you sort of pick up, right? You sort of, like... Because, I mean, like, we're talking about empire. You're sort of, like, in charge of this thing that's, like, incredibly, like, broad, right? Like, they call it, was it the British Empire. The sun never sets on the British Empire, you know? And it's, like, I think to the people who are part of that machine, they sort of see this polity that is sort of like so far reaching that includes such a plurality, right? I think that's always the sort of like thing that liberals love, is like plurality and multiculturalism, there's a very kind of cosmopolitan worldly kind of thinking that they think that they have access to, or that they're the best representatives because they know, like, because they've been whatever, they've traveled around the world or whatever it might be because of the work that they're a part of. But there's something about it. I mean, I said it before, but it's just like him being like sort of like servants. They're being like nice servants to like international capital, right? Where it's like he would rather not have like science, whatever, majority in French, because he thinks that's like a sort of like we should not have that kind of deference to like local populations, right?
Yeah, I mean, there are basically like two different ways that you can talk about what was the rich we can.
Oh, yeah.
Open ourselves and the world at large to the richness of its global diversity. So, like, there are a couple different ways, a couple of paradigms in which you can do that. One is you can, approach other countries and other people and other nations, languages, with a spirit of openness and solidarity on a person-to-person, nation-to-nation, community-to-community kind of level. Or social, or if you want to get really extreme, like social movement to social movement level, and build a web of global, solidarity and cooperation and mutual advancement. That's one paradigm. Another paradigm is to say, we should, homogenize ourselves so that transnational capital can bring investment so that I can profit from that, And that's what the class that he represents is interested in. They're not really interested in, nation to nation cultural exchange. They're interested in smoothing the like pathways of investments to come in so that you have, let's have Japanese firms and Swedish firms. Maybe even an African exporter, come and experience our diversity and we'll take a cut. Thank you very much. And they're probably not even aware of it because they're steeped in that rhetoric. I mean, these people live in like windowless conference rooms and hotels. Like this is the sea that they swim in. It's just this weird blank gray world that they is the way they experience civic life. But they have to sort of dress it up to a certain extent. And, you know, its prose isn't horrible.
Yeah, no, it's yeah. I mean, it's kind of a classic old, like,
yeah.
I don't know. What I've got the name for him. The old, like, colonial adventurers, right? Who always dream of, like, places. Oh, the places I'll go through the empire. I mean, you had that at least a lot in, like, kind of like.
Yeah, the novelized travel writer.
Yeah, exactly. I'm sure he's read a lot of that. You know, I'm sure he's read
Somerset Maugham.
James Hilton.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Of course, yeah. Anyways, this just makes me kind of like. I wish there was a sort of like. I wish this language debate was not kind of going along the lines that it's going on right now. I haven't seen quite many inroads into like sort of like breaking the hold that language has over Quebec. And not to say that like it's not important, right? But I think there's so much that like. So much that we set aside in pursuit of trying to like resolve that language debate. And it seems to be going in the wrong direction. And I don't think people like Clifford Lincoln want to take us in the right direction. I think they just rather kind of go back to the good old days.
He's just a mirror image of Francois Legault at this point.
Yeah. Maybe that's what he's just barking at himself in the mirror.
All right.
Next slide. Next topic. We're going to continue to talk about the province of Quebec. This time we're returning to what we were talking about before with our kind of public institutions. We talked about healthcare, our healthcare system. Here we have a little video from The National to begin this discussion.
Privatization is such a broad term that it's basically useless.
Technically, every doctor is a private contractor. The difference is who's providing the care and who's paying for it. In public hospitals, a knee replacement surgery costs the province around $10,000. In a private for-profit clinic, patients pay up to $28,000. But when a province pays for a surgery in a for-profit clinic, the amount is kept secret.
That's one of the challenges with understanding the cost, the relative costs in the for-profit sector is provincial governments routinely deny access to those contracts.
Ontario plans to pay for certain services in for-profit clinics, a model BC has used for years and has made changes to.
Cataract surgeries, they repatriated those services into the public sector because they were more expensive in the private for-profit sector.
The latest wait time data reveals 68% of patients in BC had their knee replacement surgery within 6 months. Ontario did better. Same goes for hip replacements.
There's a purpose for
doctors insist Ontario doesn't need more clinics.
You could do operations in this operating room. You don't need to open up new facilities.
And he says hospitals are only funded to do a specific number of surgeries per year. Governments could pay to schedule more on evenings or weekends, but the real issue is staffing.
We need people. The bottleneck right now is particularly nursing care.
But for-profit clinics recruit nurses from the same pool of workers. A nurse or doctor leaving for more money leads to longer wait times in hospitals.
I really worry that people don't completely understand the long-term impacts of some of these changes.
Studies of the UK and US have also shown private for-profit care can lead to slightly higher death rates.
So when we're looking at private financing in our system in multiple examples, it tends to have worse patient outcomes and tends to have more financial inefficiencies. So why would we be looking to expand that aspect of our existing health system?
The Angus Reid Institute survey shows political leanings tend to drive people's views on privatization, but most doctors insist there are cheaper, safer, faster ways of getting more Canadians the surgeries they need, including centralized wait lists that connect patients with the next available surgeon instead of sitting on one surgeon's waiting list. Christine Birak, CBC News, Toronto.
Next slide, please. So that's sort of the little. Hello again. All right, so here's the. What'd you think of the video first, actually? Talked about Ontario, but I think we start to see a lot of the similarities.
Yeah, I mean, I think the same dynamics are clearly at play here. Yeah, you're on the one hand, I mean, it's even more stark here. I mean, I think the quality of the work life of Quebec nurses. And specifically in Montreal hospitals is awful. Mm-hmm. The attrition rate is catastrophic. And it's been covered, widely, by even the sort of more right-leaning outlets, or the, you know, Bell Media-owned outlets, talk about this openly. And where do those nurses go when they drop out of the public system? They either go private, or they go to the U.S., or they go somewhere, or they move somewhere else. So that, which of course creates longer wait times, and wait times are on the rise. Attrition of public sector health workers is on the rise. So between those two things, you have a system in crisis. You have overflowing emergency rooms. You have gigantic waits for, you know, basic care. And these are all solvable problems. Mm-hmm. You know, I think we saw during COVID, it's like the contrasts between different healthcare systems around the world became very stark. Like, I think Japan has like twice as many beds, hospital beds per capita, mm-hmm. as Canada does. And, you know, they were able to do a lot better, right. with COVID. And, you know, I think you can extrapolate that they're just going to be a lot better overall. Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, that's the situation where we're creating we've created for a long time, let's be honest, in Quebec, a two-tier health system where, you know, you can wait weeks, months, years, maybe, for basic treatments and tests, or you can pay a little extra, or your insurance covers it. Mm-hmm. And you go to the private and you get service right away by a nurse who's not burnt out and like overwhelmed. And lovely for you if you can afford it.
Of course. Yeah.
And sort everybody of. Else. Sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry. How much you got on you? Ooh, sorry. That's not enough. You have to go and be sick. Yeah. Go deal, yeah, with the crumbling kind of like
your
public.
Your lint is no good here.
Yeah. 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 this is sort of, this article here, I have sort of like this, when I went to base this conversation around, kind of, made me feel not good. Maybe I should go see a doctor. All right. So this article is titled "Privatizing Healthcare Isn't the Taboo It Once Was, But Would It Help Quebec's Ailing System? Political parties float the idea of bolstering system with more private options. Experts question the logic." And I feel like this sort of ties into the that little clip from The National we see here about this sort of like specter of like private healthcare as a sort of solution, mm-hmm. for this crumbling,
yeah.
System. But it's like you're saying yourself, right? It's like this, our healthcare system, like everyone, there's always like, I feel like every like provincial election cycle is like, what can we do to fix the healthcare system, you know? It's always this thing is like sort of like at this, yeah. that's always like, oh, it's just like on the verge of like collapse, especially after like COVID, right? And then I think you have this thing where like so many people are kind of starting to consider, or it seems like there's this turn in like public opinion about private healthcare that seems, yeah. to be sort of on a worrying,
yeah,
rise.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's been a trend. I'd say the two big trends in Quebec healthcare, and this is in the context of Law 15, which was passed in December, just before the legislative break for the holidays in Quebec, which drastically revises the whole healthcare system. There's like 1,200 articles in this, mm-hmm. law. They cut debate short on the basis that whatever they wanted to get, go to their cottage or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, I remember Quebec Solidaire complaining loudly about this before the break, but, you know, the bill passed and that's that. But this is part of a long, much longer trend, which goes back to, you know, the Parti Québécois in power, goes back to the Liberals before them. But basically, yeah, you have two trends. One is in healthcare in Quebec. One is centralization of control and power, and the other one is privatization. Is the sort of draining the life out of the public system, mm-hmm. and empowering the private system. Allowing investment capital to profit from people's health, which is, you know, once you open that door, it's very hard to close it.
Mm-hmm.
Philippe Couillard, a former premier of Quebec, you know, took a break from politics at one point and went to work for a firm whose entire business model was investing in high growth, high revenue opportunities in the healthcare sector. What does that mean? It means, you know, when people get sick, you're making money off of it.
Yeah.
And this, I think, you know, was long understood to be a totally pernicious and destructive way to do things, because it just has horrible results ultimately. and results in people dying of unnecessary, you know, complications from not getting treatment for their, you know, for their ailments, you know, and also just suffering for, you know, years in a lot of cases. But nonetheless, that's who runs the system. So they've been, you know, but Quebec is, you know, if you go back further, it's tremendously inspiring. You know, when they, you know, healthcare in Quebec used to be delivered by the Catholic Church, which was, as you can imagine, a disaster in all kinds of different ways. But in the 70s, under pressure from social movements, they created a whole bunch of, go ahead.
The only thing I want the Catholic Church delivering is sermons. Thank you. Just wanted to get that out there.
wafers on plates. Much else. In the 70s, sort of post Quiet Revolution, or in the aftermath of the Quiet Revolution, you have social movements. You know, unions are really feeling their oats. Various communist parties are challenging for influence and power. You have mass movements of various kinds, feminist movements, all these things are happening. Mm-hmm. And in that context, you have a very progressive system that got put in place. The CLSC system, they created hundreds of these like local, and mostly largely autonomous, mm-hmm. but, you know, provincially funded, health centers. And they weren't just providing access to nurses and doctors and medical procedures and so on. They're also community organizers. Mm-hmm. Like they would organize communities around education campaigns, suicide prevention, all kinds of stuff. They were sort of leading. They led the way on providing abortion care in Quebec. Obviously, you know, post Catholic Church, that's kind of a big deal.
Of course,
were this incredible force, transformative force, and sort of created a place for local social movements and the reforms and people who want to improve their communities, a venue to express and their political power and have debates and make changes locally. Mm-hmm. And of course, every government since then hates this. And has tried to like erode the power. So, you know, try going to find a doctor in a CLSC, like good luck.
Yeah.
There's some nurses there. I mean, you know, they're constantly cutting back what's happening in these clinics and constantly cutting their power and giving it to the hospitals, which are, you know, of course, overloaded and top heavy and focused on getting gigantic, super expensive equipment that of course feeds the profits of people like Philippe Couillard and so on.
Who sell those kinds of products.
Yeah. And so the centralization of power has been continuous since then, basically. Mm-hmm. They've been cutting it back and trying to like erode the power of these incredibly innovative and responsive institutions, that were totally groundbreaking in their day. So Gaétan Barrette under Couillard goes ahead and centralizes power away from the sort of hospital boards into these regional boards. And so, if you work at a hospital, you're not your manager, the person making decisions isn't in the building. They're mm-hmm. in some office somewhere, mm-hmm. And you're totally alienated from them. And now they've gone a step further and they've said, okay, we're going to create one office that he's even more super empowered.
Right.
And of course the management principles of these centralized things are always like, okay, well, it's how do we squeeze even more efficiency out of this system? How do we eliminate positions? How do we mm-hmm. like get more out of these clearly burning out workers? Mm-hmm. How do we push them even further to the brink? The social setting is such that, you know, the person making the decisions to do that is not in any way in contact, or not in very many ways, certainly not day to day, face to face, in contact with the people who are there actually making decisions on behalf of. Right. And so it's much easier to make super damaging, you know, decisions that damage people's health and mm-hmm. like lead to injury and death effectively to some extent. And of course, lead to privatization. So all the, you know, people who are upper middle class and above go, okay, well, screw this. I'm not going to this hospital. I'm not going to the CLSC. I'm going to
my
private doctor. Mm. And, you know, and they've finessed it very, very, you know, elegantly. So the private doctors still, you can still go see them as a public patient. Mm-hmm. But then if you wanted to get your test right now,
faster.
Yeah. And not have to go through the hospital.
Sure.
You can pay $200 or whatever. Anyway, so those are the trends, and those trends are kind of coming to a culmination. I think we're seeing a total crisis, yeah, in the healthcare system, that is not being felt, I think, very much by the most, you know, the homeowner class, basically.
Sure, sure.
I mean, give or take, they're not the ones who are feeling this. It's the everybody else.
Right, right, right. The home non-owner class.
Yeah, the proverbial Montreal renting millennial who's trying, yes, to find a family doctor.
There you go.
They're not having any luck.
Let's go to a quote I have from this article about this rising trend of privatization. In an attempt to take pressure off nearby hospitals, the CAC is proposing a pair of new private medical centers in Montreal's East End and Quebec City. The privately run mini hospitals would be open 7 days a week and include a family medicine clinic, a 24-hour emergency room for minor ailments, and day surgeries. All this would be covered by public health insurance, according to the CAC. This is an article by, you're shaking your head here. This is an article by Benjamin Schindler, Leah Hendry in CBC News. This approach, I guess, to private healthcare is being supported by the CAC as well as the Conservative Party of Quebec. And I guess this kind of continues that, really, like, what they're doing here in, like, Montreal's East End and Quebec City is sort of, like, I guess they're now, those are little test centers, right, for this kind of, like, future approach that, mm-hmm, they envision of the solution to a deteriorating healthcare system. For them, the response to a deteriorating healthcare system is not how do we strengthen it, how do we kind of, like, empower the people who are closest to these fraying ends. How do, mm-hmm, we empower them to fix the solutions, which I'm sure they could be like, which they are witness to every day, right? Instead, it's how do we get some of this public money into private coffers, right? How do we introduce, like,
yeah,
to me, this is wild because it's like, I always thought the easy thing for Canadians, like across Canada, not just like Montreal, not just Quebec, for Canadians to kind of like rest their laurels on was our healthcare system, right? Mm. Like, even as much as it is sort of like fraying and like tattered, it's still like, you know, it's like, at least we don't have like too many sections of it that are like for profit, right? Of course, there's like the NDP talking about like pharmacare, which is its own kind of thing, pharmacare, dental care, these other aspects of public health that are still for all intents and purposes under like private kind of like interest, private for-profit interest. We still have this robust system, right, where you can get like chemotherapy or like knee surgeries for free. To me, it's wild to be allowing these little projects of like privatized healthcare, privatized for-profit healthcare to be kind of continuing, or to even give them any little ground, right, in this province.
I mean, the absurdity of it is, yeah, is literally you're just funneling money to private investors. That's literally all you're doing with this. And like, yeah, I love the idea of mini hospitals open 7 days a week with a family medicine clinic, a 24-hour emergency room, and day surgeries. It's called a friggin' CLSC.
It's called, like, the friggin' CLSC, people.
We've had this system for 50 years. And, you know, great. Let's fund those. They work great.
Do you think it's like...
They're
just
proven.
Do people like it because it's just like new, you think? Do people like... Because to me, I'm really surprised that like the article continues. Quebec is open to the idea. Proponents of more privatization argue that...
Well, because their experience of the system is that it doesn't work.
Right.
Yeah. So the more they have that experience, the more they're like, yeah, we need to do something different. So different is privatization. But you only find out 10 years down the line that privatization actually just means corruption.
Right. Right.
Actually just means corruption.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It means creating a money loop between private investors and political donations.
Sure,
that's literally
sure
all it means.
You have these like private interests who see the money, right, going into these like, yeah, public systems. They're like, how do we get in on that action?
But the idea is like, oh, it's more efficient. And like, yeah, it's more efficient as a way of funneling money to private investors because they pay their workers less.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah, exactly.
They privatize, you know, they're going to outsource the laundry or whatever. I mean, they've already done that in hospitals a long time ago. Let's not kid ourselves. But but they're going to outsource everything they possibly can to like, you know, precarious migrant workers who are going to get paid less. And yeah, that's efficiency, but it's actually just exploitation and profit skimming.
It's always those two.
Yeah.
Every problem, it always ends up being those two.
I mean, this is the problem with having a, you know, basic class analysis lens, is that you kind of end up coming back to that pretty often.
Exploitation.
Yeah. Get into old man yells at cloud, territory here, but, can't help it if they're repetitive in their methods.
A recent poll by Angus Reid bears that out. It found Quebec residents are among the Canadians with the greatest appetite for more private care, with 40% saying more private care would help. Quebecers are also among those most dissatisfied with the current system. I guess like talking about what we're talking about.
Yeah, exactly.
With 3 in 5 polled saying care is poor. Similarly, 43% of Quebecers who have taken part in CBC's Vote Compass survey would like to see more private health care, while 26% want the same amount and 1% want less.
This has been part of Quebec culture since like, I don't know, the 90s basically, or the early 2000s. Ever see the movie, Denis Arcand's, it's Fall of the American Empire?
I have not. I admit I have not.
Oh, a classic of Quebec cinema. But, you know, there's a very like iconic scene where it's filmed in a Montreal hospital where they're like, you know, they go in and like somebody's laptop gets stolen and like, they go and see this like union boss with like big arms who's
I'm on my 8-hour break, pal.
I'm on my 8-hour break, but we found your laptop. Like, I mean, it's just like absurd caricatures, this is just the tip of the iceberg of a bigger perception, I think, of the sort of supposed corruption of the unions and everything else that's happening. I mean, really what you're talking about, you know, it's a displacement of what was actually happening. I'm sure unions were involved in corruption. I mean, they were involved in corruption at various points. There are various exposés about it, but the source of that corruption was the mob and the fact that they were, you know, driving the cement trucks around in circles and getting these big construction contracts and not, you know, and just skimming off the top like crazy.
Of course.
So it's sort of, you know, displaced from the political class. And of course, you know, the Demarais and everybody else was sitting around just sort of, I didn't see that, you know. With the people with the power to stop it were just chilling, you know, and maybe possibly in some cases going on cruises with these various mob bosses. Or, you know, another, in the case of one Montreal mayor, having a safe that was so full of cash that they couldn't close the door.
That's,
you know,
so funny. That's like Looney Tunes kind of stuff.
Yeah, so there was a problem with like real political corruption, and I think that of course gets displaced onto the most convenient target, and in a neoliberal era when that ideology is ascendant, of course the whole plot of Fall of the American Empire is this family, this rich businessman who's working in New York brings his Quebec, you know, rural Quebec dad to like the U.S. to get the proper care and pays for it. And it's like a nice, comfy hospital, private rooms, and all the amenities and everything. And, you know, contrasted very visually with this, Quebec hospital where the like, you know, the ceiling is like, you know, has all these wires and like, you know, pipes and everything exposed and everything's under construction.
Much less cozy experience.
Yeah, exactly. And you're sharing a room with 10 other people or whatever.
Of course. Yeah.
And that's in the late 90s, early 2000s. I mean, so this has been going on for a while is my point.
Right. This is
that this has been entrenched and promoted.
Sure. And that sort of explains this kind of like public opinion kind of being more open to private ones because people kind of construe them to be like whatever, like cleaner, more efficient than our current system.
Yeah. I mean, your experience of a private clinic, you walk in, there's like a couple people waiting.
They know my name.
There's somebody who's going to help you within 15 minutes tops, if not right away. You know, you get your results back right away. it's all pretty smooth. It's like, you know, what the public system should be if it wasn't completely funded.
And all you have to do is just use your credit card.
Yeah, exactly. You just got to.
Yeah. Oh, wow. That was so easy. Well, I guess the malicious or what's the word I'm searching for? Sort of dangerous part of it, right? Where you,
yeah,
that little, like, those niceties. Not to say that it's not like we're saying that these private clinics aren't nice. It's just that the kind of what they kind of represent are the wrong solutions, or the money kind of continuing. Like, I think when I think of like,
well, like, you don't emotionally feel the difference between $0 and like $250 or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, the same way you feel the difference between like walking into a place that's like full of sick people waiting for care Correct. For hours and like, you know, dilapidated furniture and stressed out nurses who or bark at you, you know, you know, those,
you don't feel
things.
Those. No, you don't feel the money difference, but you feel that.
The emotional experience is not the same.
Yeah, no.
But the ultimate social, reality is obviously awful.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause it's, what if you don't have,
people literally just stay sick.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Let's go to our next slide.
Yeah.
And I mean, here we have this kind of analysis of thing. I guess we already it's not really a surprising analysis. We have this
shock headline: Quebec's healthcare system is worse.
Yeah, Quebec's healthcare Who system now worse than ever. No new health agency can magically solve the huge shortage of staff that's behind the crisis, and that might take years to resolve. Published December 18, 2023, and here we have the saga of our healthcare system continuing. Like you said before, emergency room overcrowding, record high surgical wait times, a lack of available spaces in nursing homes. Quebec's healthcare system is now arguably the worst it's ever been. And I think what's important is this article kind of talks about the kind of staffing shortage, right? Which is like, I think you have that video we initially watched also talk about these kinds of like, or not doesn't talk about staffing shortages, but it talks about sort of like the flight of nurses, right? To private healthcare or to potentially other provinces or even the states. And I think that's like, to add to our conversation about these private healthcare centers, they're sort of like being like allowed. I'm going to say allowed because they should not be allowed, because they're being allowed to exist here, because that they're being given room to sort of like siphon away nurses from the public system. And it's like, I could never blame the actual worker who decides to want to not be a part of this,
not have a completely alienated working situation where you don't get to choose your hours and you get all the worst conditions and you have a giant number of people who are depending on you for care who you can't help every day. Like, oh my God.
Constant burnout. The government hates you. They don't want to give you more money.
Fully awful.
I can't blame them for wanting to move to these private systems if they do pop up. But I think the fact that they are given sort of the fact that they're given that option and then they decide to choose it, and then now the initial public system is not worse. The initial public system is sort of like we're seeing short on staff.
Well, I think the question we have to ask is, okay, what are the barriers to like channeling that discontent into militancy within their unions? You know, like what are the things that are stopping that from being their outlet as opposed to just leaving being their outlet, you know? I think I don't know the answer to that. I'm not, you know, privy to the internal workings of unions, but usually I certainly have been privy to enough, you know, social democratic institutions that stifle the necessity for militancy and mobilization to know that that is a thing that exists.
Sure.
Maybe it exists in the nursing unions, maybe not. Maybe there's some other factor. But I think that's the question that you have to ask is like, okay, what are the barriers to militancy? What are the barriers to like organizing? What are the barriers to like making this a thing that people can stay and fight about?
Yeah. Let's say we have this. Let's say we have Nurse A is working in a Quebec hospital, hates it there. It's terrible. Conditions are terrible. She's being overworked. She hears from her friend that there's a private clinic being opened up, a private hospital being opened up in Montreal's East End. They're offering better pay. Conditions there are nicer. And maybe she'll even be a little closer to home. I think in this kind of scenario,
Yeah, maybe it's in the bottom floor of Pierre Polyev's
residential tower. Yeah. The Pierre Polyev Medical Center. Does she go work there, or does she see a tool for improving her space? Mm-hmm. I think I guess the choice to move to change jobs is an incredibly like. How do I say? I don't mean this in like a. It's like an individual choice, right? You're like, just mm-hmm. so I can look out for myself. Yeah. I'm gonna go there, and that's like valid. Totally understandable, especially when there are no, especially when nurse aid does not see any kind of collective militancy, like you're saying, right? In this kind of situation, if there is no, if like the union is not active, if it's always been little kind of like bickering, and if they always, I guess like if they always use the union for like little small kind of like workplace indiscretions. Which
well, in moments of demobilization, what happens in unions, I think, is that people sort of trade favors mm-hmm. and then. The people who can accumulate the most social capital by like doling out, you know, training days and breaks and plum positions and so on and moving people around and, mm-hmm. and getting their favor, you know, end up in positions of power. And that's sort of usually antithetical to, you know, grassroots mobilizing and workplace militancy and people being active, because you don't want people to be active. You just want people to be your friend. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in a nutshell, that's the sort of social dynamic I think that exists, in those workplaces. And then you have to get around that. Obviously you need a critical mass of activity and mm-hmm. to turn the tide. And those people don't like to have their position threatened because it has privileges attached to it.
Of course.
And so it's a fight, and it frequently they'll put, you know, they won't necessarily fight clean, you know, there's going to be some, so you have to, so the fact that you have to fight your own union before you fight the boss is
quite the big obstacle.
Can be demoralizing for sure, but you know, it's not a reason not to do it.
No, I do like that. I mean, it's like I feel like what you talk about using the union to sort of like as like a sort of like tool to leverage for better like social kind of good. Sort of similar to like we had a guest before talk, Felix Fox talking mm-hmm. about the original Front Commun, and he was quoting this one of the original organizers and how they saw the strike as a sort of action, the strike as an action, and the gigantic workforce that is under this kind of like public system as this sort of like potential for like leveraging, right?
Yeah.
For improvements in this kind of system. I feel like at least we see that on like maybe on the teachers, like on the front for the teachers. I feel like I have not seen that as much for nurses as well. Like I think, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? Like I feel like the gains, at least in this sort of like recent round of strikes seems like it feels like the wins are much more for the teachers than they were for the nurses, or maybe not just the nurses, but like rather than like a healthcare system at large. Mm-hmm. It's kind of interesting that mobilization didn't quite happen.
I mean, teachers are in a good position because they have relationships with the community, mm-hmm. you know, through the kids. People care about their kids. People mm-hmm. care about, you know, hospitals is more fleeting, you know, like
true.
The people who are in hospitals are, you know, not always, but frequently not in a great state to be part of a political movement. They're vulnerable. They're sick. They're, you know, needing care. Mm-hmm. And so, the relationship that people have tends, you know, the people who are mobilized around hospitals are the people who have like chronic conditions or need constant, you know, need ongoing care, stuff like that. And which is of course a minority of the people who are interacting with hospitals. You know, one hopes at least that the people who are going to hospitals are getting better and then going home and doing their thing. It's the organic level of political support is different and potentially harder to mobilize. Not impossible, but also, you know, just nurses are the level of like burnout track that they're on just seems extreme at the moment.
Of course, yeah, of course. It's hard to mobilize from that kind of sort of place. Yeah.
And doctors are being, I think Quebec's like the second highest doctor salary in Canada. So they're doing okay. And I think that was an explicit decision by Gaetan Barrette under the previous Liberal government mm-hmm. to sort of separate the, like, you know, yeah, create a widening gap between the nurses and the doctors mm-hmm. in the sense that they don't, like when you're making $400,000 or $500,000 a year, you're in a different you're in a different level of the stratosphere when it comes to class position. Mm-hmm. And so it's very hard to relate.
Widen that gap within their workforce.
Yeah, exactly. You know? So, yeah, you create like a, you create a coalition of the most powerful authoritative people in the medical profession, being sort of funneled toward privatization. And then the nurses are just sort of, on a different tier. And you do have like, you know, you do have exceptions to that, countercurrents like the Médecins Québécois pour la régime public, who are like, you know, doctors who are for the public system. System. And so that's good, but it's like, you know, it's a minoritarian countercurrent. So that's where, and the, you know, they speak out on a regular basis, but I think what we've seen with the teachers is that the very least you need 500,000 people to go on strike and like have really clear demands and big organization and big support to change anything at all, or even make tiny gains. So to turn the tide on healthcare, I think we require something similar, if not more.
On that note.
Yeah. On that note,
we're going to
let's get militant.
Yes. Let's get militant. That's our next segment. No, it isn't. Thank you so much, Drew, for coming onto your show.
A pleasure.
Our healthcare system, kind of sick. Tune in for Hello Goodbye Lines with Ode Simo. Take care. Welcome back to Metropolis. Today we have Ode Simo for our segment, Hello Goodbye Lines. You thought it was funny that I said your name in the
entire name, yeah. It's okay.
Of course, we're professionals. Ode, you're a journalist here at CUTV. Mm-hmm. What do you have for us today on Hello Goodbye Lines? What's a story that you've been kind of following?
I'd say a story that I've been following is the issue of missing murdered Indigenous women, girls, disparate, and trans people here in Montreal. But more specifically in relation to the newest place that Résilience Montréal is trying to open. So last December, I was on the show and we discussed the issue of funding for Résidence Montréal and how they were looking to have a fundraiser so they could remain open. And we talked about the letter that they sent to Montreal officials to ask for $500,000 to help them keep the place open. And I do have news for this, although it's not a big update. I know that they did receive an answer where they were told that they would receive funding shortly. Shortly is not exactly, like, we don't really know what shortly means.
There's no promise date to shortly.
Yeah, exactly. It could be a week. It could be by the end of 2024 or even later. But Nagouset, the day of the fundraiser, said that this is the last update that they had about the issue.
Nagouset is the director of Resilience Montreal?
No, she is the director of the Native Women's Shelter.
Okay.
The executive director of Resilience Montreal, although the two places are connected, is David Chapman. David Chapman is the executive director of Resilience Montreal.
Okay, yeah. Thank you.
But yeah, exactly. So we don't know when they're going to be able to have the funding. And I know that this is not also the only issue that they're facing in terms of funding. Once again, they're trying to open a new place, a new shelter. That would be double the space of the place they're currently at. And they're in need of $6 million to be able to transform and renovate the space into a facility for homeless communities. And Indigenous communities who are disproportionately affected by homelessness. And I know that right now, like, they want to create the new space and have it focus on wellness for the communities. And I know that when Nagouset was discussing the space, she mentioned how, you know, they would be able to offer services that they were not able to offer in the past space, which would be, you know, medical assistance, medical services, as well as counseling services, which are very important, as we know, for Indigenous communities, considering that they face state violence as well as systemic violence mm-hmm. at disproportionate rate, especially mm-hmm. when trying to get services, you know, like medical aid or, you know, legal protection or anything like that.
There's a lot of barriers.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. There's a lot of barriers that non-Indigenous people do not face mm-hmm. And have no idea about. So that's their plan. That's their plan for this space. And it would, again, like, you know, like I talked about how the space would be double the space, mm-hmm. double what they currently, where they currently are, which is very important to, you know, discuss, because that means that more people will be able also to access the services. It's not just better services. It's also more space for people and more members of the community that could be able to profit off of those, services.
Increasing their capacity, I guess, to offer these kinds of services.
Exactly, exactly. Because as we know, Indigenous women are once again facing violence at a very like increased rate here in Montreal, especially in Cabot Square. And as I mentioned in the letter, like as at the same time as they asked for funding, they also discussed the violence that Indigenous women, girls, two-spirit, and trans people face in Montreal. And I know that like between August 2023 and November 2023, the Ishkwe project was able to get statistics on how many cases happened and how many people were found themselves facing violence. And we do have the information, and we can put it on screen, and I'll also read it. But yeah, they noticed that there was a steady increase of violence against Indigenous women at Cabot Square. Mm-hmm. The Ishkwe Project statistics from August 22, 2023 to November 8, 2023, which is like 2 months and a half apart, like 2 months and a half, showed that there were 13 missing persons cases, 8 missing persons cases without involving police, 5 hostages kidnapping situations, 6 situations of human trafficking and sexual exploitation, 8 cases of single incident sexual assault, 24 cases of intimate partner violence, and 1 murder, suspicious death. So
in just a 2 month period,
in just a two month period.
And also in just, this is like
Cabot Square.
Cabot, so this is a very small, very small area.
Yeah, it's a very small area, and even this, like those statistics that we just discussed, they don't even cover because these are just like the most of the incidents that were reported. Mm-hmm, you know,
of course.
And in terms of statistics, I know that in Canada, Indigenous women make up for 4.3% of the population, and yet they account for 16% of female homicide victims, mm-hmm. as well as 11% of disappearances cases.
So there's clearly it's incredibly disproportionate. Yeah, exactly. It's alarmingly so.
Yeah, and I know that this is something that one of the project manager at the Ishkwe project also discussed, and I will quote her on this. Her name is Laura Aguirre, and what she said was that whenever there isn't access to a basic need for someone in a really vulnerable spot, like for Indigenous women, there's always a pimp or a man who is violent who's going to say, "I'll give you a meal, I'll give you a place to sleep." But the cost is that the Indigenous woman will face a lot of violence in exchange for having safety or access to basic needs some of the time.
Mm-hmm. I think that's, I mean, you see right there, right? It's like, without, I feel like when I hear about stuff like that, it's like incredibly concerning, because it's like that, whenever it's like you have these kinds of institutions that are like providing shelter to homeless people, to Indigenous men, women, especially, I mean, specifically here, we're talking about the women. Mm-hmm. When they don't get that, when these places close, and when they need that kind of, like, necessities of life, we have people here who understand that these are vulnerable people, and they're going to use that against them, right? They're going to offer them some shelter, some food, a meal, like she's saying.
Exactly.
But then with it, of course, comes violence.
Yeah, exactly. And I think this has been discussed so many times at events for murdered and missing Indigenous women, girls, two-spirit, and trans people, where a lot of people also know that the chances of them actually facing the consequences of their actions of, like, being violent towards Indigenous women, murdering them or abducting them, are very, very low. And it's not just, like, people that you wouldn't, you know, think would. You know, it's people in institutions that are supposed to protect, mm-hmm. you know, Indigenous communities, you know, like police, as well as, you know, people in political institutions as well. People know that they're going to get away with this. So, you know, they act upon, yeah. you know, those, yeah.
They know that there's a sort of a gap in whatever yeah, kind exactly. of, like, justice that they can sort of put themselves there and they can kind of be unpunished, or that yeah, exactly. they know justice won't kind of come for yeah. them so soon. Yeah. So soon or quick.
Yeah, I know that I had an interview with Jessica Kijano a few years ago, and this is exactly what we talked about, is that, you know, for example, police being able to get away with, you know, being violent towards Indigenous women, because Indigenous women will not have anyone to go to except mm-hmm. their own community, mm-hmm. Because, you know, you can go to, if the police is, like, you know, violating you, you can, you know, you can go towards police and say, like, this person did that to me, because, yeah. you know, they won't believe you. Like, it's your like, ta parole contre la sienne. Yeah. I don't know the term in English. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Sorry, I apologize for that.
That's fine.
But, yeah, and that's exactly a lot of the things that are happening to women of the Indigenous community. And this is why, you know, having events like the annual memorial, for missing, murdered Indigenous women, girls, two-spirit, and trans people is so important. That was last week. So last week, I know that Local 514 was able to cover it. But it's not the only event that happens annually. There's also May 5th, which is the National Day of Awareness for Missing, Murdered Indigenous Women, Girls, Two-Spirit, and Trans People. And there is also October 4th, which is the National Day of Action. Mm-hmm. And we've covered both events. We also have a few clips that we can show about this. But, yeah, we were able to cover both events in October and this February.
Yeah, let's check out the clips of these dates, these commemorative dates.
If I ever go missing, I didn't go freely. I love my children too much to leave them. If I ever go missing, find me. Find my body and give my children peace.
I'm here at a march being held in honor of murdered and missing Indigenous women, girls, two-spirit, and trans people, of whom more than 4,000 have been reported murdered or missing over the last 30 years. More than 4 years have passed since the final report of the National Inquiry into Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls has been released. Only two of the calls have been completed, and organizers are saying it is desperately needed to finish the rest.
I testified, and one thing I testified was, I remember saying that violence, it's everywhere we go, it's everywhere we gather, and it's even where we were conceived. And so if we think about that, that is the enemy, that we have become so used to violence. How are we gonna give violence, you know, a good fight? And I think that's breaking the silence. So if we think about
yeah, so that clip was, I think, from this fall, past fall.
The October 4th, vigil.
Yeah. Evidently, I was at that one. It was a very strong turnout, very powerful words spoken. And then we have a second clip here.
We have a second clip of Ilan Gabriel talking at the February 14, like the 33rd annual memorial that happened last week. Yeah.
If it wasn't for the work of Indigenous women like Sandra Lovelace, Mary Truax Early, there would be no changes to the Indian Act. We would still be in this archaic form of governance, if you can call it that, an authoritarian kind of governance that afflicts our people so that when someone goes murdered or missing, the police do not take it seriously. And every single vigil, I have to remember this woman because she sticks out in my mind as one of the first stories I heard. A 19-year-old from Manitoba, Helen Betty Osborne, going to school in Winnipeg, was brutally raped and beaten and killed. And for 10 years, the policing authorities knew who did this. But because it was the norm that any man who violated an Indigenous woman could go with impunity, they did nothing. Imagine if Helen Betty Osborne were alive today, maybe she'd be retired, but she could have fulfilled her dream to be a teacher. And that's what this is about, is fulfilling those hopes and dreams of the women who, because they are Indigenous and because they are a woman, they are attacked. And we are the disposable people in this society, and that's got to change. This is 2024 now. It's got to change.
That was Ellen Gabriel speaking just last week.
Yeah, exactly. And even I think something that's important to talk about regarding both speeches that we've heard is that the spaces of those vigils and those marches are used to basically warn people that they would never go missing, they would never abandon their mm-hmm. family, or that they have the right to grow older and have daughters of their own and become grandparents and all of this. That, like, if they go, like, they have to tell the public that if I go missing, this is not because I went away like someone would tell you. I wanted to stay, and my life was cut short, mm-hmm. or I was abducted. Mm-hmm. And this is, again, what's important. Like, those spaces are, those events are there to give a space to people to come forward with their stories, family members, and also people who personally have experienced being abducted and, have faced violence. But it's also a way to, raise awareness to what is happening, because this is a national crisis. This is a crisis, and people don't talk about it as such when it actually is. It's just the importance of, like, the municipal, the provincial, and the federal government, like all level of governments, to actually listen to Indigenous communities, Indigenous activists and supporters, that there is an issue and it needs to be like the violence that Indigenous women, girls, two-spirit, and trans people face needs to be eradicated. It needs to be something that does not happen anymore, mm-hmm. and especially not at such a disproportionate rate.
Of course. Even in that video, she speaks about, like, the impunity, right, mm-hmm. against these kinds of the perpetrators of this violence, and how the police is not really.
They know they'll get away, and
just like we were saying before, right? I mean, to me, it's almost like this. Evidently, like the history of police here, the RCMP in Canada, it's not really a system mm-hmm. that was made to help Indigenous people, right?
No, exactly.
It's not really a system that was there to, like, ensure Indigenous people got justice for these kind of violent crimes. If anything, most of the time they were the kind of perpetrators of this violence, right?
Yeah, exactly. And mm-hmm. we could get into the history of, like, you know, how police came to be in different countries and, you know, what it was really for.
That can be your next episode.
Yeah, my next episode. But, you know, if you look at it, you know that police was not invented to actually, you know, serve
or people. Protect.
Yeah, yeah, serve or protect, especially people outside of who they consider, you know, could give back to them in mm-hmm. terms of, like, you know, like power, money, and all of these mm-hmm. things. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like, exactly like the case of people who get away with murdering and abducting Indigenous women, it did remind me of a case, the case of Alessi Tukabig. I hope I say her name right. She was from Nunavik, and she disappeared in Montreal in March 2023. And her remains were only found in September 2023. This is like 5 or 6 months apart. And her remains were found in the apartments of two brothers. If I'm not mistaken, the body had been left on the couch for months. And the thing is, the family of Alessi Tugepig actually came to Montreal and asked for a report to be filed and a case to be open, but it took more than 2 weeks for this to be done. Mm-hmm. Every time the police would decline opening a case and filing a report, or would find an excuse to say that, you know, like, it just doesn't work this way. They even said that they didn't think that Alessi was in imminent danger, which obviously she was, which again is why the case was not open right away. 2 weeks is usually, to tell you, I think it's 24 hours. And even then, a lot of people get help before 24 hours. Yeah. But 2 weeks is like, you know, the chances of finding someone alive after two weeks of disappearances are very slim.
Very low, yeah.
Very slim. And yeah, her family, her sister, it's like the reason why her remains were actually found is because the Ishkwe project, as well as Tugepig's sister and mother, pressured the police to not only search the apartment, but once again, like, continue the investigation, because they wouldn't have.
Of course, they're taking their time. Yeah, exactly. It didn't seem to be a pressing thing for them.
They were pressured into actually continuing. And once again, her remains were found in the apartment of two brothers, like, months later. And I don't know, like, I'm saying this out of memory, but I remember hearing the story either online, but I know that they asked, I'm pretty sure that they asked the brothers why, but this is like, I'm going to say that this is like out of my own memory and mm-hmm. it's not factual. Sure. But I'm pretty sure that they asked the brothers why they didn't come forward to the police. And I don't remember their answer, but the exact answer, but I know that they answered with such, like, you know, kind of like, you know,
just, like, blasé.
Yeah,
attitude.
Exactly. Like, yeah, like, yeah. You know, we didn't. And again, like, you know, they are very, they only have only a month after the discovery of Alessi's, like, remains, they were actually suspected, officially suspected. And one of the brothers was actually supposed to appear in court in January, but the court session was pushed to April 2024. So we don't know what's going to happen, you know, if it's going to be pushed again, or if, you know, we're actually going to get anything out of it.
Yeah, it seems like delays upon delays upon delays.
Yeah, exactly.
This justice is taking its time here, which is, I guess, the unfortunately, the trend for Indigenous women. I think, yeah. To me, it's absolutely wild that, like, a month after they discover the body in these brothers' apartment or house.
Yeah.
It took a month to actually put them in, like, yeah. To consider them suspects.
One of them was suspected 2 weeks later, and mm-hmm. the other one was suspected, like, a month or so later.
Sure.
Yeah, so even at the same time, even despite the remains being in their home and their reaction to when being asked, you know, why they didn't come for it.
Yeah, yeah.
And just, like, you know, 6 months of, like, searching for, like, obviously searching for your sister or your daughter, and, like, you know, pressuring the police to actually do something, only for them to say she's not in imminent danger. So, yeah, you know, yeah. we're gonna take care of it. When we take care of it is, you know, 6 months. Who knows what could have happened in 6 months?
I can't imagine. Yeah, I can't imagine exactly. Being that family and having to force the police to actually do their job, right?
Yeah.
What we think their job is.
Yeah, exactly. Alice's mm-hmm. sister had to come down from Alberta to so that, like, the police would finally let them file a report. Yeah, so it's very...
It took an outsized effort on the part of the victim's family to get the police to do
exactly
this.
Exactly, with the Ishkwe project.
Of course, yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, like, yeah, it's very alarming. And, yeah, that's exactly why, again, these events need to happen. And I know that, like, Laura Aguirre did mention that, you know, she felt like a lot of people were saying, like, why doesn't the Ishkwe project do more? Why doesn't Resilience Montreal do more than... Mm-hmm. But the thing is, they are doing a lot. Like,
of course.
They are doing a lot. And as much as they do, they still need the assistance of, you know, all levels of government and other institutions mm-hmm. to be able to, you know, put an end to the violence and, you know, the violence and discrimination that indigenous mm-hmm. communities, but specifically indigenous women, face. Mm-hmm. And I know that, for example, you know, like the final report for the calls to justice and the recommendations. So like the national inquiry into missing and murdered indigenous women, girls, sisters, and trans people was the final report was published in 2019. Mm-hmm. And
that's 5 years ago.
5 years ago. Yeah. Like close mm-hmm. to 5 years ago. And you already said it in the video, but only two of these calls were implemented.
Yeah.
And that's not even 1%. Yeah. That's like less. That's like 0.85% of mm-hmm. like all the calls. And that's 5 years. And we say it's 5 years, but that's the final report. There's an initial report that was actually done in 2004. So all in all, it's like 20 years. And yeah. obviously, like, that's officially written down and mm-hmm. published. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't like put into like we don't consider the calls for action that were done in real life to events that were done by, you know, sending letters to the government or having, you know, public demonstration and all of these things. So like we have 20 years of officially published calls for justice, and out of all of them, only two have been implemented. Mm-hmm. That's absolutely nothing.
Yeah, unacceptable.
Yeah, exactly. That's very low. And just to like also give you an example of like the type of calls that we done, just to show you, you know, like how some of them, like obviously I don't work in the government, but I feel like some of them could easily have been done since like the 5 years of the final report, mm-hmm. but also since the 20 years of an initial report.
Yeah, let us know which ones.
So for example, these are just five examples that I took off the top of like the list when I looked. So one of them is develop and implement a national action plan to address violence against indigenous women and girls. A second one is ensure that indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirit LGBTQA+ people are represented in governance. A third one is take all necessary measures to prevent, investigate, punish, and compensate for violence against indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirit LGBTQA+ people. A fourth one is recognize indigenous languages as official languages with the same status, recognition, and protection provided for English and French. And a fifth one would be increase accessibility to meaningful and culturally appropriate justice practices by expanding restorative justice programs and indigenous people's courts. So these are just five out of like 231 calls, just to give you an idea of the type of things that could be done.
And these are a lot of ones that could easily be done.
Especially like the, you know, indigenous women being represented in governance. Like it's really not, it's something that could be done. Yeah. And all of them could be done, but just to show you like, you know.
Yeah, really the political parties aren't doing much to mm-hmm. kind of seek out that kind of representation among them. I know the NDP likes to boast that they do, but it's always like,
yeah.
I think we had the Mumila Kakak who's representing Nunavut, mm-hmm. and she was this Inuit woman who was elected to government. But then after however many months of her term, she kind of resigned because as much as she was there, she didn't feel like she didn't have the sort of necessary supports from either the party or the government. I think she talked a lot about how as she's in the House of Commons as an MP, mm-hmm. an MP of mm-hmm. a federal MP, security would ask her questions about, and they would kind of doubt like whether or not she should be there, right? And it kind of, I mean, to me, all this stuff, including the police stuff, kind of shows that like these systems of like power we have, they're not really like, they're not at all built for indigenous people, and they're not really built receive them. And any efforts that could even like reform them to the point of having towards these kinds of calls, it seems like they're not really being taken seriously. They're not really being put into actions. Like a lot of these, you chose like this very, I mean, it, like I've worked in government and like they throw a lot of money around. They put a lot of effort mm-hmm. into organizing a lot of somewhat useless things. That effort could easily go into it, like inputting some of these. A lot of these are just high level kind of initiatives that like I know the government has the capacity to do, and they don't do it. So it's clearly like not on a priority for them.
No, exactly. A lot of people say that they don't listen, but I don't think that it's that they don't listen. It's that they don't they don't care. Yeah. They honestly don't care. And it's like, Ellen Gabrielle mentioned this at the event last week at the annual Memorial March, saying that, you know, like, they are expected to, you know, go by Canadian law, but Canadian law doesn't do anything for Indigenous people and or in no way connected or adapt to Indigenous law. It's really not for, you know, it's not, there's no support system for Indigenous people through Canadian law.
Wasn't really meant for them.
No, it wasn't. And it's, you know, we could go into this more, but a lot of laws also are made to, I could say, eradicate certain communities and just, you know. Not have to take care of them.
It's not really a system of care. A lot of these laws, most of them is just kind of a corporate bickering between people with power who usually are a certain race or have been historically.
Yeah. And as you said, as soon as someone from a certain community, from a specific community does get elected to be part of, you know,
these kind of power structures.
They don't get the support needed to be able to make the change that the let's say like the political party was so happy to discuss during their campaign, you know. And we've seen this a lot of people are driven to I don't know if I use that word right, but driven to quit before they can even do anything. They're pushed out of the, you know, of the structure before they can actually implement any type of change.
Yeah, that structure never really had the space or resources for that person. So
it's often just, you know,
just a token. Tokenism, of course.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Incredibly frustrating.
Yeah, that's exactly, yeah.
Thank you so much, Ove, for bringing this forward. I think this is an incredibly important topic. I'm happy you have eyes on this, and I'm happy you're bringing it to Metropolis to report on.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Of course. That's all for today's episode, folks. I hope it was informative. See you next week.